Since 2005, Blue Hat has been where the security research community and Microsoft come together as peers.
To debate and discuss, share and challenge, celebrate and learn.
On the Blue Hat podcast, join me, Nick Fillingham.
And me, Wendy Zanoni, for conversations with researchers, responders and industry leaders, both inside and outside of Microsoft.
Working to secure the planet's technology and create a safer world for all.
And now, on with the Blue Hat podcast.
Welcome to the Blue Hat Podcast, Dr. Katie Paxton-Fear. Hi, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
We are very excited to have you. It's just me today. Wendy, unfortunately, is unable to make today's recording, so it'll be Katie v. Nick. And you are coming to us from across the pond, as we like to say. Somewhere in the UK, is that accurate?
Yeah, Manchester. So where all the football clubs are from. Don't ask me about football or music. That's the two things the city is known for. And I know like nothing about either of them.
And of course, when you say football, it's soccer, right?
Yeah, soccer.
You know, that's Americans, which I am, despite my accent. I am an American. Whenever I hear football, I have to sort of think, what are we talking about here? Is this soccer? Is this NFL? Is this something else? And obviously Manchester Beatles, right? Or was that Liverpool? No, what's...
Liverpool Beatles, Manchester Stone Roses.
Stone Roses.
But it's just a big, like,
yes,
music
the second
scene.
most famous band coming out of the UK, the Stone Roses. That was sarcasm. I do like the Stone Roses, but I couldn't tell you a single song of theirs.
My dad knows, like, the manager of the Stone Roses, and obviously they're such a big deal in Manchester. It's like, I know nothing about them. Absolutely nothing.
All right, well...
I see some nice art.
Yeah. Oh, no, they have a... I think I have one of their CDs, and it's like a Jackson Pollock sort of splatter art thing on the front. I remember sort of seeing that first and going, oh, that's really cool, and then going, oh, that's the Stone Roses, and then I know them. We're not here to talk about Stone Roses, but we could. We are here to talk about you, Katie, and your session that you presented at Blue Hat in October of 2023, Blue Hat V21. You came over to Redmond, which we greatly appreciate. That was a huge trip. That was a lot of time away, many miles to travel, and you came and presented on an evergreen topic in some ways. Your title of your session was How to Turn 70,000 Noobs into Hackers. And noobs, obviously, is, you know, folks that are new to whatever it is, newbies, and how to turn 70,000 of them into hackers. And obviously, we'll talk about that, but let's back up a little bit. Dr. Katie Paxton-Fear, who are you and what do you do here?
So my name is Katie. I have a lot of different hats. I have a PhD in defense and security, AI plus cybersecurity. I used to work as an academic. I still do teach undergraduate students cybersecurity topics, ethical hacking. My students hate me for it because obviously, my in-person classes are not quite as good as the YouTube videos, but of course, I also have a YouTube channel, and actually, my own presentation title is now out of date, because I have 75,000 subscribers now.
Nice.
It's gone up.
All right, well,
but,
that's good.
Yeah, I make YouTube videos teaching people how to get into security, specifically bug bounty hunting, hacking, pen testing, and my approach to my videos is it's like a course. It's like it's the 101 bug bounty, 101 hacking course you wish your university taught and that you wish it was free. So that's the whole aim of my channel, is just give people cool education with some slides and a very academic approach.
That is awesome. We will get into that shortly, but I want to learn just a little bit more about your qualifications and about your academia. So your PhD is, you mentioned in part, you know, you said the magic words or the magic letters AI. So you're probably at the forefront of AI and its role in the cybersecurity space, in the information security space. I mean, if that's hyperbolic, you know, pull me back from the edge there. But obviously AI is the buzzword in security now, and we're all talking about that. You obviously studied it in depth. If you were defending your PhD in part against it, is that right? How's that work? Tell us about your study.
Yeah, no defenses were. So I started out doing natural language processing. So all the LLM kind of AI comes under the banner of natural language processing, which is the idea of doing machine learning AI on specifically text rather than everything else. And there's been like huge jump forwards in AI, literally like within the past 10 years. We saw the deep learning really take off for image recognition, for example, that makes all kinds of things like self-driving cars possible. And each kind of little field of AI has kind of had its moment in the spotlight. And after ChatGPT broke, I ended up speaking to a colleague of mine, like in the break room, and I was chatting to him. I was like, it's finally time. It's time for NLP to be the popular one. We're finally noticed. Because NLP really, you know, it gets such a bad, or had such a kind of bad reputation because it's very easy to get caught in the language, it being very obvious that it's like machine generated language versus human generated, especially before, you know, we saw gaps and like increases, LLMs, whatever. So a lot of what like our experience was very much being kind of like the black sheep almost. It was crazy. You know, pre-pandemic, I was at a NLP conference and everyone's talking about BERT. Nobody knows what BERT is anymore. Like nobody cares. Everyone's talking about LLMs. And that's been crazy to see. So I started out doing NLP because I was just fascinated by language. So for my undergraduate dissertation, I ended up doing an exploration of undeciphered languages. So there's a bunch of text that was written in the Bronze Age, and we have no idea what it says. Absolutely no clue. And so when it comes to like how we actually read those and try and understand what that culture was like, we've lost it. And so that's really what got me interested in NLP. And then I ended up in cybersecurity because I needed something that would actually be funded. And archaeology is not on that list. Not fun archaeology. Just go say what these tablets say. You have to actually do something useful.
Yeah, you have to go and charter a small plane, and you have to fight your way into an underground temple. And what's the plot to Indiana Jones? So just to sort of paraphrase that, so your interest was initially sparked in sort of language. You were into language. You focused on undecipherable or undeciphered languages, and then saw security as an avenue into maybe a more lucrative or sustainable path. Is that a fair recap?
Yeah, I think I could summarize it best by the story I tell, which is, so I got a degree in computer science. I finished my degree. I went and got a proper developer job, a proper good job at a local company writing a CRM. And I hated it. I hated it so much. I was so bored. I went into work every single day dreading it. And I had this realization as I was walking to lunch one day. I was like, I hate my job. I need to change it. Unfortunately, I had the realization that I wanted to quit my job and go do a PhD in like September, November time. So all the PhDs were closed. It was literally just like two PhDs that were still open. So I was like, I'll apply for one of them. And the other one rejected me. So that's how I ended up in security. I never really intended to get into security. I always intended to do more AI stuff than security. I kind of accidentally ended up here.
Look, I need to come back to undeciphered languages. So it's 2024. As of today, are any of these texts that you looked at and studied still undeciphered, or have they sort of been cracked? Because I feel like, you know, that's a perfect task to throw LLMs at, and that's a perfect task to throw AI at, and, you know, just seemingly endless computational cycles to decipher undecipherable text.
So there's been some advances in the field. The main problem we have is that, so some languages, we have stuff like a Rosetta Stone. So the Rosetta Stone has three different languages on it. It's got Egyptian Demotic, it's got Greek, and it's got Egyptian hieroglyphs. And we can essentially cross-reference the words. Think about, you know, you've got a book in French and a book in English, and you build a dictionary by just going through saying, okay,
The same book. You know it's the same book in English.
Yeah, you know it's the same book in French. So yeah, you can just start to build it that way. But the challenge comes when we don't have what are called parallel texts. And in those cases, we have no idea what they say, because we have no idea how they were used. Some of them, the only reasons we know how it was used is looking at what it was talking about. So you might be really familiar, because there's a very famous cuneiform tablet that was somebody complaining about the quality of, I think it was gold.
Socks? Oh, it was gold.
Yeah, it was. I can't remember off the top of my
head. I thought it was something quite benign, like socks or sandals or something. But yeah, I keep going. I'm sorry.
He hated the quality of it. So right. he wrote this complaint letter. It's like the oldest complaint letter, because fundamentally language wasn't used to like tell stories or really any further than accountancy in the Bronze Age. So if most of what we have is we have sheep, 3, horse, 1, wine, lots. And that's what we've got. So we still don't know what they say. There's loads of stuff that's just undeciphered. There's a great book called The Mystery of the World's Undeciphered Scripts, which is like this. I'm putting my hands up. It's a good like few inches thick of just all of these different writing systems that remain completely undeciphered. And that's not even to say about books like the Voynich manuscript, which are intentionally like encrypted, I guess would be the best way to say it. Encoded, encrypted, so you can't read it.
Or it's someone that was designing a troll for, you know, for the future. And they're like, I'm going to have him guessing several hundred or thousand years from now.
Yeah, it's like early Twitter.
Do you find that the work that you did and the interest that you had in undecipherable languages in language translates today into your work in the information security, cybersecurity field, in sort of modern AI, in education? Like, do you find that connective tissue?
You know, I think it's really interesting. I've never actually thought about it, but yeah, I do think so. Like, quite a lot of the reason why I find undeciphered scripts so interesting, I mean, I still have books on them. Like, I still read them. I still
You can't read them because no one's deciphered them, but you've got the book. Oh, sorry.
the books about it, I can.
Oh, I see. But they actually,
I can look at them and go, oh, that's some pretty pictures. Some lovely triangles. But I've never really thought about it. But both of them, it's like you're playing Sherlock Holmes. Because when I approach, like, a hacking target, I don't know what's behind it. I used to be a developer. I kind of think, okay, what mistakes would I have made if I was building this? And I always describe it as kind of like Sherlock Holmes, because I'm making assumptions about how something was built, but I don't actually know. I'm very much using my instinct, using my intuition, using my experience to kind of back it up. But for the most part, I just don't know. And one of the reasons why I enjoy hacking so much is not getting large bounties or getting loads of money. What I like is the process of going from not understanding how something is built to having this really in-depth knowledge that I kind of share with the developers. It's me and them having a conversation, if you like, through the medium of hacking. So I'd never really thought about it, but yeah, it does come from the same place. There's a mystery out there and it should be solved. And that's kind of how I view security as well.
Your first sort of hack, your first sort of vulnerability or exploit or sort of logic flaw that you discovered, is that a memorable story? Is that something that do you remember how you sort of got into this space? What was the little kernel of interest that was sparked? And I just blended nine metaphors. Sure. How'd you get into this?
I got involved because of a HackerOne live event. So HackerOne run these events where they fly out the best hackers in the world to go hack on a single target. And when I was a student, I was a PhD student doing security. One of my friends who's based in London, and obviously stuff always happens in London, I went to university with them. They were like, hey, look at this event. They're looking for mentees. Is that something you'd want to do? And I was like, no. I wouldn't, I don't really want to do any hacking. That sounds really hard. And I have a lot of other things going on. Anyway, I eventually got bullied into it because my friends were like, oh yeah, so-and-so is going to be there and be all these people from uni. And some of them moved abroad. So it was like, okay, right. I need to make an effort to see like my friends from university. So I'll go. So I applied, I got in, I was surprised I got in. And I took the train down to London with a friend of mine who also applied to be a mentee. And I'd never done any hacking before, never even seen like a web request in its like request form. I knew what they were from doing web development, but I didn't know what they looked like. Never used Burp. Literally, I cannot stress how inexperienced I was and how little I knew what I was doing.
Were you upfront with this in your application? Or
it was a mentee program.
I kind of did
tick the boxes because it's like, you know, you've got to know nothing.
Okay.
But I showed up, they had like mentors to help us. And I was playing around with the tool. They showed us like how to install Burp Suite. It took forever to install on their Wi-Fi. and I started hacking. The target was Uber. I was sure I wasn't going to find anything. In fact, I distinctly remember talking to Tatiana, my friend who came along with me. I remember telling her, we're not going to find anything, but let's just have fun here. Let's just see what we can do. But we're not going to find anything. And so I'm about an hour in and I go up to mentor. I was like, huh, this is kind of weird. So I call over the mentor and he's like, yeah, that is weird. And so what we saw was a put request. Now, if you develop APIs, you're probably familiar with what a put request is. However, you probably don't actually use it because put requests are in like the RESTful API standard that nobody follows because everyone uses get and post. So it was weird because of that. Like if I was a developer, I wouldn't have used a put request. I would have hacked it together like every other developer who's ever making RESTful APIs. You don't do it properly. Like, why is it done properly? So anyway, we started having a look at it and we realized there was no authentication on that API endpoint. So you could essentially access somebody else's order if you like. You're like, okay, that's a really cool finding. We're playing around with it. I'm putting in some really large numbers, changing the price to be in the millions of pounds. I'm like, oh, that's a bit weird. What if I put a minus in the front of it? So I changed the price from minus £1,000 or from £1,000 to minus £1,000 and it worked. So not only could I change the order without being logged in, I could also increase or decrease anybody's order. I was like, oh my God, this is a vulnerability. Like I've actually found something. So the mentor and I were getting really excited. So we spent all day working on this. It gets to, God, I think it was like 20 minutes before the like deadline shut. There would be no more reports after that. And we're sitting there typing the fastest we ever typed. I'm getting like stress mental break, like blocks, because I'm trying to write this report and I'm like, I don't know what to write. I don't know what to write. And then my mentor, she had been like, she'd hacked like so much stuff. She'd hacked like a switch. She has so many like credits on all these different bug bounty programs. She worked for HackerOne. She was getting stressed. She was like, oh my God, this is too much. And we get both the reports in literally by seconds. And she stood up after that and was like, right, I'm having a cigarette. This is ridiculous. So literally we were shaking. And about 2 hours later, after I'd finally, you know, come down a little bit and calmed down, someone from HackerOne came along and said, you're getting a bounty. You're getting $1,000. And I was like, shut up. I am not. And yeah, I got my first bounty. It was $1,000. And I was obviously in London. So I spent half of it on yarn for my knitting at a fancy yarn shop in central London. And then I saved the rest for a house.
Okay, so recapping. So your training experience as a developer, but a developer building CRMs, didn't love it, sort of wasn't super impressed with that. You come to this event, you've never hacked before, and the thing that sort of sparked your interest, the thing that you narrowed on, was the fact that like in all of this seemingly human code or human structure and logic in which we hack things together as opposed to following the rules of a framework, here's this sort of usage of something that is out of place because it was, as you say, it was like the correct way to do it as opposed
to... There's nothing more suspicious than something done properly.
Right. So the inverse might be if, you know, everything's, you know, written sort of according to spec and then all of a sudden there's a hack in the middle of it and you saw everything that's sort of a bit sort of hacky and then you found something that was according to spec. Did I get that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you just played around with it and managed to order a car where they arrive and they paid you £1,000.
Yeah. I don't know how far it would have actually gotten through. We didn't fully test it for obvious reasons, mainly because when we were testing, we had to make like genuine like Uber requests.
Oh, wow.
And people were like picking them up, like actual Uber drivers.
Oh, no. And I was gosh, like, that could have gotten confusing and expensive.
We didn't know if that was like an actual driver or if that was hopefully somebody in like the war room who was just ticking like the the cab rides off because they didn't want it to get into the live system. But yeah,
there's like 75 drivers just circling the building that you're in, all confused and shaking their fists at the sky. Oh, you did? Oh, okay. Also, the $1,000 that you won was probably, you probably spent it on ghost Uber rides as part of your testing.
I mean, it was Central London. I spent it on the Uber ride getting back to the train station.
But you had some left over for yarn. So how do you spend $500 on yarn? Is it sort of like alpaca or, you know, some sort of rare Iranian rabbit or something? Like what, how, is that easy to spend $500 on yarn?
Depends where you go and what you buy. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yarn is one of those things where there's quite a lot of handmade elements to it, which obviously increase the price, like hand-dyed yarn. But also, yeah, fibers. The most expensive yarn I've ever seen was like $120 for, I think it was muskox yarn off the top of my head.
Wow.
And that was enough. That wasn't even enough to make a hat. That, wow. You would need like 4 balls to make a hat.
So what do you like to make with all of this yarn, with all of your hacker yarn?
So there is a thing about this, which is my lucky socks. So I do quite a lot of sock knitting. And whenever I go to a hacking event, I always wear hand-knit socks. And in fact, I'm wearing hand-knit socks right now. And I always wear hand-knit socks because to me, they're kind of like a little totem. Like they kind of give me good luck because every bug I found, I've been wearing hand-knit socks. The downside of this is, of course, I've never been in a position where I wasn't wearing hand-knit socks and I found a bug because I wear hand-knit socks a lot. So how much that logic really works out, I don't know. But yeah, I buy sock yarn and then I make socks out of it. And then I bring those to the next event and I just keep going.
Lovely. And so at what point did you decide, okay, I now need to start a YouTube channel and create courses to teach people how to do this thing that I've done. What was the time frame between, you know, getting your, you know, going to this event, getting your first bounty and deciding to start teaching people how to do it on YouTube?
So after the first event in London, I was really fortunate that I got to go to Vegas. So they invited me to come be a mentee in Vegas. And I mean, I live in the UK. Vegas is a long way away. If somebody offers you a free trip to Vegas during DEF CON, like it didn't matter how unqualified I felt and I knew I was and how much I thought this was just a fluke and I'd never find anything else, I could go to Vegas for free during DEF CON. So I said yes and thought, well, if I find something, it's good. If I don't find something, oh well. So I was 100% sure the Uber thing was a complete fluke and it was never going to happen again. And then when I was in Vegas, I was talking with some of the other mentees. They were actually knew what they were doing. A lot of them had like security experience more than my AI with a little bit of security in it. And I was chatting to them and I realized that where I was in my learning journey, like learning this skill, I was like one small step ahead of them. It wasn't huge. It wasn't like this big like chasm of, you know, I knew everything and they didn't. I realized that I had one key advantage in this, which was me 100% focused on how can I actually find my first vulnerability? Like, how do I not just start to learn how to use these tools, but use them to find something? And the way I was thinking about how the application was built was slightly different to the way they were thinking about it. And so I got back from Vegas after getting another 2 bugs and getting another few bounties and also spending it on yarn while I was in Vegas. What do people knit in a desert? Turns out they knit for the inside air conditioning weather. So I came back and I was like, I want to make like a video or something because I think I've got something to add here. And I'm of the generation where, you know, you grow up watching like a teenage year, seeing a lot of YouTubers, right? And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to make a YouTube video. How hard can it be? So I made my first YouTube video and it was just going through all the tabs in Burp. But instead of me explaining, okay, this is the repeater, it does this functionality. This is the intruder, it has this functionality. I instead focused it more on how you actually find bugs with it. So the repeater tab allows you to repeat requests. What you want to be doing here is making really small changes in the request to cause security outcomes. And I then continued making videos. People liked that first one, so I made some more. I went to some more live events. I found some more bugs. I made more videos. And my videos have always been like, okay, I am like two steps ahead of the viewer that I'm targeting. Like, I am not the expert necessarily. I am really just giving them a little bit more insight. And people really liked it. I started to grow a lot during the pandemic, said yes to quite a lot of events that were ridiculously timed, had a few meetings at like 3 o'clock in the morning. I did a podcast once, it was 2 a.m. I had coffee. I did the podcast and I went back to sleep. Coffee didn't even do anything. And yeah, my channel just grew. I got some really good feedback. I just kept on making the videos that I would have liked to have seen when I was slightly earlier in my journey. And that's always been my kind of goal with them, is this is what I would have wanted.
And you've now trained, maybe that's the right word, you've now sort of helped at least 75,000 noobs turn into hackers.
Yeah, it's insane.
That's an amazing milestone. Congratulations.
What I used to do when I was getting like 20K and 10K, I used to look up venues that would fit that many people, because that way you can really visualize, you know, how many people are actually watching this. And I got to like 56,000, I want to say. And I was doing my usual, I'm going to look up venues. No venue in the UK would offer you 56,000 people apart from a field. And that
like
was what
O2
I stopped
Arena
doing that
because, or Wembley or something.
Yeah, they don't offer their prices online though.
Oh, I see what you mean.
They don't go, you have to contact them to find out their actual space. But yeah, it was after that that I was like, that is crazy that like I cannot even imagine speaking to that many people in a room.
So what's the most recent video you've created? What was the topic?
Most recent video I created, most recent video I uploaded, because I've got videos I haven't uploaded yet.
Your choice.
I made one about note-taking, about the kind of different notes that you might want to take when you're hacking. So looking at like how to build up a hacking knowledge base and how to turn that into something you can actually use again and again and again every single time you're looking at something new. And then for content I recently, in December, did some Try Hack Me Advent of Cyber stuff. So I was like one of their hosts for Advent of Cyber, which I always really like doing because I take like weird stuff I have no idea how to do. Like I always go for the defensive stuff where I'm completely clueless because I always learn the most there. And so, yeah, I made some videos about that. That's probably the most recent ones that have gone up on my channel.
That's fascinating. So instead of sort of gravitating towards the platform, systems, tools, software, apps that you are very familiar with, either as a developer or even a user, it sounds like you're saying you actually gravitate to the stuff that you're not familiar with, that you don't know anything about, because that's where you're going to learn the most. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm always just one or two steps further ahead than my viewer. I don't really think I'm a huge like expert in any one specific thing. I see like the advantage I give people is that I can look at a technical topic, break it down into like simple terms, and then present it to somebody else. You know what they say, right? Those who can't do, teach. And that's me.
Right, but that's not the pejorative at all. That's very much in the positive sense. And when you came to Redmond in October for Blue Hat, you were sort of in stealth mode because you had left your full-time teaching position, as I understand it, and you were moving into to a new company, which is where you are now.
Yeah,
can you tell us a bit about what you're doing at your new employer, or are you still in stealth mode?
No, I'm outside of stealth mode now.
Okay.
I work for a company called Traceable. It makes an API security solution. I work in technical marketing, which means I'm the one person on the marketing team that knows absolutely nothing about marketing at all. Like when they talk, it goes straight over my head. My job is to be the technical person. My job is to be the person who knows a ton about API security. I'm really fortunate I get to go to a ton of events. I'm going to RSA because I just found out I'm speaking at RSA this year, talk about API security. I'm going to Austin in March to go speak about API security. I get to make like videos for our like social media platforms. I do webinars. We're currently producing an API security masterclass, which is like the API security course. It's like, it's completely free. It's just on Zoom. It's interactive. And it's going to be this like year-long thing where every single month there'll be a new API security class that people can join. And yeah, I get to work with like our research security research team, be kind of like a member of that, help them get people to notice their work. It's really fun. I really like it. It's a lot of what you do as an academic, but paid better. Like, that's truthfully. Nice.
And you were saying before we started rolling that you're in the process of reading some new 300-page document or something. Is that is it API documentation? A new sort of policy document?
Yeah, it's PCI DSS version 4.0. It's the new payment standards for the e-commerce industry. It's called, swings and roundabouts, right? Sometimes you're going around to the US three times in like 3 months. And in other times, you're reading a 300-page document that crashes your web browser whenever you try and scroll down too much.
And I said to you, I asked you if you were going to use ChatGPT to summarize it. And you sort of giggled and said, no, because it's often wrong, or you don't trust it. Was that a joke response or is that, I mean, obviously it's important to read this document and understand what's in there, but ChatGPT or, you know, these sort of GPT implementations to sort of summarize documentation, you're not a fan, not a proponent?
It's kind of weird. I love natural language processing. I love AI. I love language. Like it's why I even chose to do a PhD. But I just don't trust it. I think it comes from knowing so much about how those systems work and knowing that this is just regurgitating either like somebody else's work and it's just not citing it, or it's making something up completely. I think I just know too much about it that I'm like, okay, I just don't trust its output. A lot of people will come to me and be like, you just don't like technology. I love the technology. I can't trust it. Not for like important stuff. Maybe I use it for D&D. That's what I used it for. I used it for playing D&D so I could generate newspaper articles to litter around my town on certain themes. Would I use it for doing like regulations where I'm trying to give somebody advice on how to follow like security standards? No, absolutely not. But D&D.
Gosh, I have two questions in two different directions. One is your D&D newspaper article litter stuff. But the other one is, so what would make you feel confident in a GPT summary of a 300-page, you know, regulatory document? Would it be, you know, some sort of more visibility into the process, the rules in which the AI system was summarizing, like being able to sort of see what was happening behind the scenes? We talked about before we were rolling that, you know, I feel like when I saw early implementations of GPT, there were these sort of confidence scores, or you would see this thing that says like, you know, this was generated with 86% confidence or 12% confidence. And those seem to be long gone. But what would make you, Katie, more trusting or more wanting to use those types of tools?
So AI explainability, which is like the formal technical term for it kind of telling you how it works under the hood, would definitely be good. The problem is the way GPT, specifically large language models and like generative AI in general, it tends, and in fact, OpenAI has said this like about one of their like music models, they tend to overfit to the training data. So that is to say, if you give a LLM a lot of text data, it will tend towards replicating that more than it will actually processing what you've prompted for it. And people have actually been seeing this. A lot of people have been complaining recently that ChatGPT is getting worse. And I recently wrote an article about why this is the case. But I honestly, like my take, my spicy hot take here, is that this might be as good as AI gets. Because now we have to train AI on something that could be potentially AI generated. Because the amount of explosion in 2020 after ChatGPT got released of AI generated content, it's gone from like 0 to 100 in like a week, let alone over the period of months. We have entire books that have been written by GPT. We have new models being like joining the marketplace. It's not just ChatGPT, you've got your Bard, you've got whatever else. And people will sit there and compare the output between the two and use that. AI-generated art is everywhere as well. And the problem is when you train AI on AI-generated text, it sucks. Because AI-generated text has these like weird artifacts. And if you're looking at like mainly human text and the odd AI-generated piece of text, those artifacts will be rare in the data. However, the more AI-generated text you can have, the more like crazy the output becomes, and it becomes far more about training AI that these weird AI-generated artifacts are more and more common in the data set. So I use a good example, which is a few years ago, Google Translate was spitting out prophetic Bible verses because the Bible is one of the world's most translated books. So when Google Translate builds a new model, you want to translate between, you know, obscure language to English. The Bible's probably in both those languages, and the text is relatively the same, depending on the version. And because you have parallel text, you can start to build up a kind of one-to-one glossary. The problem is as you deal with lower and lower resource languages, and if you give the model nonsense, you give it dog 18 times, the model just spits out the training data. So it was spitting out, you know, the end times are coming, Jesus will be reborn, from dog 18 times. And that's what tends to happen with AI. The more AI-generated stuff is in there, the output is so dependent on the training data. Bad data in, bad data out.
Got it. So a low resource language in this example is, as you say, like a lesser known or lesser spoken or lesser documented language.
Lesser spoken, lesser written language.
Right. And so if you're trying to build a model where you're translating from that language to another one and you only have a very limited set of resources to compare against, any sort of mistranslations, butchered translations, lacking translations, whatever, will find their way into the model because that's all they have to build it on. And so in this example, the word dog might have been repeated accidentally in the training text, and there was nothing else to say that's wrong. And so somehow
it just spit out something next to dog, maybe.
That was
in the Bible. It's kind of weird. It's not really clear why it happens per se. It's just a hallucination.
And so then I'm trying to think of how that may then translate, or how that may then connect to this space in security. So, and using sort of AI and cybersecurity. So if you're utilizing, you know, if you're looking to rely on a large language model or an AI system in some capacity for something very obscure, does that mean something that's sort of esoteric or doesn't have, as you say, many resources potentially, something that's very, very new maybe, or something that's very archaic, does that mean that you should be, you know, approaching it with a bit of skepticism versus something that's incredibly common in the information security space or in any sort of, in any capacity?
I think it depends. So there is a push now towards what are called small language models. And small language models are the idea of large language models, but small. But you use like very niche training data and you use a very small amount of training data, because large language models, like if you want to make your own large language model today, you'd go bankrupt. There is a reason why like Microsoft can make them, because there's a bunch of Azure compute power that they have. There's a reason why OpenAI can, and it's because they've already purchased like a ton of server resources to run these. I think it was in ACL in 2019 where they did the maths, it'd be impossible for a new company without the backing of a cloud provider to make a large model. There's just not, they could not purchase enough compute power. So a lot of the kind of issues around training models also becomes, well, if we do want a model of some description that maybe is done in-house so we can trust the output, we know the training data, maybe you want it to be copyright work-free. We know that image generators and LLMs have both been trained on copyright data. We're still waiting for the court system to find out what's happening in those lawsuits, whether or not that's legal or permissible or it's not, and they're going to have to pay some kind of fine or some kind of use. It's still ongoing. So a lot of companies are looking, okay, right, we don't want to get sued, so we're not going to use data that already exists. We can't afford to spend billions of dollars in Azure compute time. But we do want to make something that our users can use because they're using ChatGPT and putting customer data into it. And we want to give them the opportunity to use that technology, but please, for the love of God, stop putting sensitive information into ChatGPT. And so the solution is small language models. So a lot of people are looking at small language models. There's a lot of other like really interesting looks about how you can start to fine tune models, though I will say what's called model collapse, the like AI being trained on AI stuff. Even with fine tuning, we really can't stop the model degradation just by fine tuning it. It doesn't really work that way. So that's another kind of solution, is fine tune the model. Me personally, like for anything more than like the odd, can you rephrase this for me? Because I can't figure out how to word it. I just wouldn't do it. But then maybe that's also because I actually enjoy writing. Like I enjoy the research process, but it's fantastic for D&D. Like for D&D, you want to tell people, ChatGPT, please write me a newspaper about the town leader's daughter going missing in the woods 3 days ago. And can you do it in this particular style? And nails it. Fantastic. Amazing for D&D handouts.
Well, I'm glad that you've been able to find an application for ChatGPT and large language models to use in your life in some capacity. I feel like we definitely need another episode here, Katie, because we have run out of time and I have so many questions and and I'm sure we could go in so many more directions. You've been so generous. Thank you so much for your time. Before we let you go, where can people find you? I know you're inside a PhD on the Twitter's X's or whatever it's called. Can you give us some of your handles and your URLs and where people can go to follow you and consume your amazing content?
You know, the great thing about having a last name that's double-barreled is that you cannot be confused with the other Katie Paxton Fair. So you can look me up, Katie Paxton Fair. It's usually me, including all the embarrassing stuff I made before I was 13. Don't look at that. That's technically illegal in the US. You can find me as Insider PhD on everything. YouTube, Twitter, Mastodon. What else are we moving to now? Blue Sky.
Semaphore and smoke signals, I think.
I don't have my smoke signal set up yet. So
actually,
that's
I wonder if
there probably is
some micro messaging tool called Semaphore and or smoke signal. So I shouldn't make that joke anymore. Dr. Katie Paxton-Fear, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much. First of all, for coming to Redmond for Blue Hat. It was wonderful to have you there and to have you share your journey and share your knowledge and your skills and passion in this space. Thanks for being on the podcast. Love to talk to you again. I think we should definitely set that up. Thanks for rocking the Blue Hat hoodie or the Blue Hat sweater, which people can't see because this is a podcast, but maybe we can get a photo of that. Yeah, thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you very much. The pleasure is all mine.
Thank you for joining us for the Blue Hat Podcast.
If you have feedback, topic requests, or questions about this episode,
please email us at bluehat@microsoft.com or message us on Twitter at @MSFTBlueHat.
Be sure to subscribe for more conversations and insights from security researchers and responders across the industry
by visiting bluehatpodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.